I've been wanting to circle back to here through our very expansive topics, but is the Lucifer's fall, and you write about it being an intellectual error that leads to a moral error.
Yes, they do. Yeah, I mean, intellectual errors present you with a false world, and so the choices you make in terms of action and will, when the alternatives are false, end by leading you into vice because there is no right choice.
What I'm wondering now is what the how the parallel exists between that and the confusion of the psychic and the spiritual. Because one way of understanding Lucifer's fall would be not so much rebellion as dissociation, as in he experiences this split, this rejection from God, or this distance from God. He longs to return for unity and rebels against the reality of the present by dissociating into this the fantasy
Yeah, right.
of being God.
So he says, rather rule in hell than serve in heaven. That's very accurate, you know, what Milton Satan said. And certainly, you know, the idea that through service one does not remain just an abject slave on this lower level. Through service, one transcends oneself and returns to paradise. But this isn't understood. You know, if pride supervenes, this is not understood. You know, pride says, well, all right, you know, now that you've been kicked out of heaven and you have to, you know, live as a slave and instead of as one of the sons of God in the higher world, you know, either do it and suck it up or rebel against it and say, I'm not going to take this. You know, that's where the darkening, that's where the intellectual error happens. It's right there. You know, because, but it's true. You essentially have to submit on the level of the will before the intellect completely opens, before you can really know and see how submission to God leads you back to paradise. You just have to do it. And this is hard because how can you do it if you can't see it? Well, it's because there's such a thing as faith, and faith is I call virtual intellection, virtual gnosis. And what did St. Paul, he called it the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Even if you don't see it, somehow you see it. Even if you don't know it, somehow you know it. You know, and that's a very mysterious thing, you know, because knowledge of the truth is not mysterious, but how one moves from illusion to knowledge is deeply mysterious.
Well, isn't a big part of the appeal of the psychic that we can see it?
Well, yes, I mean, nowadays, if we're moving, which we are collectively, from a monotheistic period to a polytheistic period, it's because it's so easy to produce phenomena. I mean, the collective psyche is blown wide open, you know, partly by psychedelics, but also by all the other shocking, you know, developments in the world, you know, by nuclear weapons, by social breakdown, by electromagnetic pollution, God knows what it is. But, you know, the psyche is blown wide open. And so it's very easy to have experiences of discarnate entities of various kinds, or gods or demons or the whole list. It's hard to avoid, you know, according to some people. I mean, actually, we're now getting a new lease on atheism, where people are saying, you know, I think there's some people who got involved in the New Age and channeling entities and all of this, and it worked for a while, but it didn't manifest to what they wished to manifest. It did not manifest prosperity or something, and so they became cynical and said, you know, atheism is more, you know, is more reliable. But beyond that, it's still much easier than it used to be to have paranormal experiences. I mean, UFOs are part of our contemporary experience in many ways. And not just that, but, you know, all sorts of other paranormal stuff. And So it's so easy to have these experiences that people say, well, this is what's really going on. God is simply, an abstraction. We don't see God, and so maybe all he is really a moral imperative, or a moral, set of moral rules that were invented by some priesthood at one point, in order to control our behavior. That's God. I don't know about God. I've never seen God, but I've sure seen plenty of the spooks and ghosts, and I just saw a UFO a couple of nights ago. So people go with the phenomenology of what they see. Seeing is believing, I fear. And that's very much what the modern world is like. So once again, understanding the unity of God, that there's a spiritual level above the psychic level, and that God is truly one in every conceivable sense, is now becoming once again esoteric knowledge. At one point, I think it was esoteric knowledge. I think among the ancient Greeks, you would have, publicly, in the civic religions, you would have polytheism, and everybody thought in terms of many gods. But there were some philosophers and some possibly people in the mystery schools who would have an esoteric revelation of that there was actually a unity beyond all of this multiplicity of gods. Plato certainly talked about the one, and the Platonic tradition talked about the one, but that was relatively esoteric. And then when after Christianity, Christ came, and Christianity became, the essence of Western culture for, at least 1,000 years, and continued a lot longer after that, it became it was quote natural to think that there's one God. And then in my lifetime, people would say, oh, well, the man upstairs, the good Lord, will take care of it, I guess the man upstairs is watching over me. Even if they weren't very religious or went to church, that's the way people thought. And then that changed in my lifetime, and suddenly, I fear that psychedelics had a lot to do with it. See, it's interesting. Psychedelics came into society at the very time the Catholic Church was being destroyed. Exactly the same year, the same few years of the Second Vatican Council, the church was getting deconstructed, and psychedelics were filling the void, and that's not an accident. But anyway, because of psychedelics and other things, our world is filled with spooks, and we encounter them all the time, more and more, and so we start to look at the world in terms of spooks, and we think that, polytheism becomes more plausible than monotheism, and this is a big fall. But it's interesting to see this, because it makes me believe that the ancient polytheisms must have been instances of degeneration from an earlier monotheism, because I saw exactly that process happen in my lifetime. Monotheism be deconstructed and become polytheism. So.
Well, regarding psychedelics, they certainly haven't gone away, and I think they're probably enjoying a comeback with ayahuasca and all this other stuff. And I think that, I mean, the whole question of religion is quite beguiling and confusing, because obviously we've got the new atheism, we've got transhumanism, we've got scientism, all on the rise, not to mention kind of ideologies of sort of postmodern identity politics and stuff that have all the fervor of religious zeal and fanaticism.
Yes.
But at the same time, I would say there is a revival of monotheistic religion. Like, even listening to Jordan Peterson, he's done this series of lectures on the psychology of the Bible, which I have to say, there's a lot of good in there. But I'm listening to them with my, my critical ear to for warning signs that this is, just part of the ongoing social engineering program to secularize religion by fusing it together with science and with psychedelics and whatever else they can, use to stitch together some sort of utilitarian religion in which God becomes subject to our own human understanding, definitions, and
Yes.
therefore will.
Yeah, and it may be that those who envision some sort of one world government or regime have realized that polytheism ends up to be the kind of tribalism that global regime would wish to suppress. And so they may be bringing, I hate to be cynical like this, they may be bringing monotheism back in a very, as you say, practical or, for purpose of social stabilization, not out of any kind of piety or mystical insight. Could be.
Of course, it's not either or, though, is it? Because we have agents of, well, in Grenon's term, the counter-initiation, who
Yes.
are not necessarily witting. They've simply taken on the cultural memes, to use a Dawkins phrase, taken them to heart, have embodied them, and they genuinely believe that they're evolving religious ideas and creating, upgrading
Yeah.
moralism and religion in a way that will actually be.
Actually, in Ganon's terminology, those would be the pseudo-initiates. That's the pseudo-initiation. In his terminology, the counter-initiation are people who know exactly what they're doing. They are there to destroy religion and to replace it with an inverted religion, and they're working to engineer just that. But then when that gets diluted into popular society, popular culture, then you get pseudo-initiation, which is what the New Age is largely, and other things like that.
So let's talk about Jung briefly, because Peterson is a Jungian. He's obviously basing a lot of what he's presenting to the world. Essentially, he's attempting to create a framework for, as I say, a new relationship with God and religion and a new kind of morality or moralism by which to live. He's even had this book, Rules for Life, 12 Rules for Life. It's like his own version of the Ten Commandments, upgraded to two free commandments. And it's the best-selling book in the world. I don't know if you heard. So this is.
Did he receive these 12 principles in a visionary experience like Moses did on Sinai, or did he just make them up?
He's not claiming divine revelation, no, perhaps fortunately, or whatever.
Well, then that's just his opinion, and it should be taken just as that. It might be have some interesting things to say, but it can't replace the Ten Commandments
Well,
because
no, I
these were
mean,
given by God, and his stuff was not given by God. He doesn't even claim it.
well, no, so this speaks to my point about how the times we're living. Most people are not, I don't know about most, because who knows with numbers, and there's a lot of Christians still around, but there's a certain subset of society which simply is too skeptical to take on the idea of truth or rules to live by as coming from
Right.
divine revelation. They need a whole pragmatic, psychological, scientific argument behind them, and that's what Peterson is attempting to provide.
That may not be all bad, but if it remains on that level, it becomes a counterfeit of the truth. If it leads people beyond that to faith, which it may or may not, then it could be a good thing. But if it replaces faith, then it's not a good thing, no matter how rational it may be. I mean, in the French Revolution, the revolutionaries enthroned the goddess of reason upon the altar in the Cathedral of Notre Dame, and or was it Chartres? I forget which. But in any case, you can't worship reason like that because reason is nothing but a reflection of something higher than itself and a way of making systematic sense and seeing the implications of something that has come to you not through reason but through direct intellection, through direct vision. And you can't, because I mean it's like a robot or a rational God or a God created by a process of rationality is like a robot created to look like a human being.
Right. Well, it brings you back to Lucifer again, and this image I have of him of in this dissociated realm in which he's essentially creating objects to worship, like he's worshipping the creations of his own dissociated intellect and thereby creating his own hell, which.
Yeah, well, and that's what every ego does. Everybody does that. They may do it in a very uninteresting, pedestrian way, or they may do it in a very grandiose way, but it's all the same process.
Yeah. So what I mean, applying this to what to an individual's relationship with God, it seems as though there is a valid attempt to understand God, to find terms by which to relate to God, even as a concept. I mean, it's kind of inevitable that we're going to be grasping like this because we're hardwired to function conceptually and through action
Yeah,
and,
and we have to do some if the traditional religions, which I always see as the highest expressions of truth in the human world, if they're no longer plausible to us, we have to do something. And it's just I have no idea how that will work out, and it might be a good thing, and it will probably be both a good thing and a bad thing.
Well, what occurred to me just now, I was talking to you, is this, I mean, one of the obvious themes of this is all through Jung's writings about God, is that modern man with his developed intellect and his deeper, supposedly deeper knowledge and understanding, I question that obviously, but has to recalibrate his ideas about God as if God himself is evolving. There's this idea, right? But actually, it seems that to me the reverse, I mean, you could turn that around, it would be close to the truth, is that God, being infinite and eternal and essentially unknowable, if God is going to reinvent himself in countless different ways, we're going to be the last to know about it. Like, there's no way we can actually
Yes.
impose our
Yeah,
interpretation.
and it's only if we identify a particular image of God, a particular conception of God held by a particular culture, if we identify with that with God, then we say, well, but since that's changing, or since that is no longer as effective as it used to be, and we need a new conception, therefore God himself must be changing. That is unwarranted. I mean, the problem is our conception of eternity, of something which is beyond the realm of change, is seen through the lens of the world of change. And when we see it through that lens, we see eternity as a kind of a terrible, petrified, paralyzed, motionless, stone of reality that crushes all possibility. And it's just, and we need to get away from that because that's impossible. We do not see that eternity is full of life and motion, even though it doesn't pass, even though its essence doesn't change to another essence. In that essence are all essences, and all essences are continuously manifesting in every possible combination. And it's alive, it's moving, it just isn't passing. And we don't see eternity that way. We don't see God that way. We see God as either, a foolish figure like an old man with a white beard in the sky, or as a terrible stone that settles on the crown of our heads and crushes out all initiative. Therefore we have to come up with something else. If we could have an intuition of the actual level of the divine, then we could accept changes in our religious conception, but they wouldn't be it wouldn't be done in rebellion against the older conceptions. We would see the truth in the older conceptions. We would see that they were not just past or not just fixed, but they were part of the ongoing self-manifestation of God, and that self-manifestation continues. And I think it's possible that much more, renewal and change and development and whatever you want to call it is possible within the context of the traditions, if they are understood on a deep enough level, than is possible outside of them. The problem is they're not understood. They're taken as idols. I mean, the worst, what I say is, religion is the best of pursuits and the worst of idols. Those who make an idol out of their religion, and particularly if it's a true religion sent by God, have done a terrible thing, and they've created their own Lucifer. Obviously, we can see this in the Wahhabis and the Takfiri terrorists in Islam. They've turned Allah into Lucifer because they have no conception, no understanding of their own tradition, and of what is possible, and of the fact that much is possible within it. They just want to, put the lid on it, and that. If you put the lid on it, it will explode. You can't do that.
So how easy was it for you to, if that's Probably going to sound like a strange question now, but how easy was it, or how graceful was it for you to convert to Islam?
Well, I did it through Sufism. I did it through Sufism, and with the help of the traditionalists like Virchow Schoen and his school, and he would say that adopting a new religion is not exactly this, when you understand the transcendent unity of religions, it's not exactly the same as converting, where you say, I used to believe that Christianity was true, and now I think I see the problems with that, and how could this, this man in Judea actually be God, and I don't believe any of that anymore. Now I believe in Islam, which is more makes more sense, and it's more, it's more cohesive and it works better for me. It wasn't like that. Actually, what my wife and I were doing at one point, we went as far as we could with social justice, liberation theology, Christianity, in the time of the revolutions of Central America, with a job. And since I mentioned her, here she comes. Hello. Would you like to say hello to Grayson?
Hello, Jason.
I'm just about to talk
Hello.
about Santa Venetia.
Oh.
Yeah. So we were in this little, we became lifetime elders of this little, of the Presbyterian Church, the little church in Marin County, which was getting involved in the sanctuary movement for Central American refugees, because the idea was the U.S. is, training death squads to go down and terrorize Central America, and that's why there's so many refugees and immigrants and refugees coming to this country. And so it's our job, as Americans, to give them sanctuary, because our government is creating the problem that's driving them out of their homes. That was
Right.
the idea. So we went pretty far with liberation theology, and with, I was corresponding with Ernesto Cardenal, who's the Minister of Culture of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and we're trying to bring him up. And we got involved in the sanctuary movement to give shelter to Central American refugees, which put us up for 5 years in federal prison for conspiracy if they'd wanted to go after us. So we got very much involved in that, and it was very intense, but it was, it was a Christianity that where love and service were, and spirit, and the spirit were very intense, but they didn't have sufficient form. And so it came to a bad end in many ways, besides the fact we were smoking dope almost every day. So I kept saying that Presbyterian Church was the commune I never had in the 60s. I finally got it in the 80s, So after that, we spent some time. That's basically, after that is when my wife and I started to look around in the New Age and see what was going on. It was very informative. But at the same time, we were going to the Sufi dancing started by Sufi Sam, Samuel Lewis, who is sort of a missionary from Sufism to the hippies. And there was sort of, it wasn't really Islam, but it was Sufism, and it was getting there. And then we decided to take initiation in the Nimatullahi order, which we were in for, I was in for 20 years. My wife left earlier to do something else. And then, after the sheikh of that order, Dr. Javad Nurbakhsh, passed away, which it was a very important thing for me to do. I learned a lot. And also, what I did is stop drinking. And I stopped, and I pretty much stopped using marijuana. I probably smoked marijuana 3 or 4 times after that, and then that was over. And I just sat there recollecting my psyche after years of craziness, not just psychedelics, but, dream work and many psychic experiments. So it was good for that. But the problem is, they really, as I was sitting there, they were departing from Islam and becoming a cult. And so when Dr. Nurbakhsh passed away, I took initiation, took bay'at with my present sheikh, who's of the Alawiyah, one of the branches of the Alawiyah. His lineage goes directly back to Sheikh Al-Alawi, Ahmed Al-Alawi, who was the one who initiated Virchow Schoen. So I'm much more at home in this organization, and I don't have to you know, I don't have to repress all the things, all my misgivings, which I got very good for sitting for 20 years repressing my misgivings. Well, thank God I don't have to do that anymore. So, and then after that happened, what came into my life was the covenants of the Prophet Muhammad from Dr. John Andrew Morrow wrote a book called The Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of the World, in which he, you know, was bringing back out of scholarly obscurity covenants written, concluded between Muhammad and Christian communities of his time. And they all uniformly commanded Muslims not to kill or damage the buildings of or attack peaceful Christians, but actually to actively defend them, as it is said in the text of many of these, until the coming of the hour, until the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly I had a social expression, which I thought, you know, I would never do again after what we were doing in the 80s with the sanctuary movement. I was just said enough politics. But then it came back all by itself. And so and in this process, I moved more in the direction of an understanding of exoteric as well as esoteric Islam, you know, through the influence of Dr. Morrow. So, you know, it's all got slowly more complete. So that was my course.
And how old were you at the beginning of that course?
How old was I? I was 40. Wasn't I 40 when I joined the Namatalagis? I think it was 40.
Yeah,
I was around there. And when did I join the Alawis? So 2009 or 10 or something like that. Yeah. So about, you know, not quite 10 years with them, under 10 years.
Personally curious, as you probably tell or guess, and part of the context of talking to you is in the middle of Lent, and I don't think I've ever done Lent, or maybe I did it in my 20s or something. I was raised atheist. My father was very virulently anti-religious, and my mother was kind of a proto-hippie, so after she left our father, she became more kind of overtly spiritual in the sense of her language and stuff, but she certainly wasn't religious in any sense. As I said, at 20, I had a sort of turning point, various factors, health romantic disappointment, the combination of those two things sort of shifted my focus to the more transcendent. But that actually led me to a sorcery path. There was no way I would have considered a religious path at that point. But I did, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think God guides you as long as you're going toward Him, even if you're going through some very dark spaces. Whereas if you get to the threshold of His house and then you balk and you say, "Well, I think I'm going to go back and do a little more sorcery," that's when you really get into trouble.
Right.
So.
I don't think I'd done that. I mean, I was just about to say that the inception of my sorcery slash shamanic slash occult path, which lasted about almost 20 years, was a sense of the divine. If I had, I don't know if anyone had asked, because it's really, people mean different things, and I might never have actually wanted to acknowledge a belief in God to somebody, because I would have felt that they would have misunderstood, or their idea about God wasn't my own. But I
Yeah.
think internally I had a felt experiential sense of God.
Yes.
It wasn't a vision, it wasn't anything like that. It was just a very strong intuition that my soul was longing for something and I couldn't find it, and therefore there must be something that I was longing for, and I identified that tentatively to myself as God, as a benevolent sentience to the universe,
Yes. Well, I mean, then that's almost more reliable than a vision, because a vision can always be knocked out by a different vision, you know?
right, true.
It won't always be, but you know, that sounds. And I'm just thinking of my wife's experience, Jenny's experiences, as she's told me about it. I mean, she came out of a very abusive childhood that went up until, you know, I guess when she was about 20 or something, and she finally got away. But during that period, looking at her old poetry, there was some way that she, out of absolute need and with no sense, no intellectual sense of theology or even God or of anything of a spiritual nature, she just existentially intuited that there was something beyond all this hell, because there had to be, you know? And I believe during those years she made a profound connection with God that she only realized later was that, you know, and then that allowed her to, you know, deal with religion and deal with a lot of the changes of religion and going from, you know, one Sufi order to a second Sufi order and then to Orthodox Christianity, and finally now she's going to a traditional Sede Vacantist Catholic Mass, which was essentially something that was opened to us by Ramakumar Swami, who actually became, at the end of his life, a traditional Catholic priest and an exorcist as well. He worked with Melanchthon Martin and the Father Melanchthon Martin in the New York area. And so we essentially got that through him, although he didn't preach it. Because, you know, Jenny saw that as a possibility, so that's what she's doing now. And you know, if you have your own, I believe if you have your own relationship to God that came not necessarily through any tradition or any, you know, valid, recognizable tradition, but still you have that intuition of God, this will allow you, God willing, to go into a tradition and to accept all the norms of that tradition, but without being oppressed and limited and constricted by it. Because, you know, you have your relationship to God. It is your own and no one can take it away from you. And because you have that certainty, you can see how the God that you are already certain of manifests through that tradition and how, you know, provides graces and provides insight and provides moral balance through that tradition. Whereas if you don't have that initial sense that God is real and you say, I gotta get my life together, or, you know, by God, you know, I'm by God, I'm gonna become a Muslim. You don't mean by God. You mean I'm gonna become a Muslim because, you know, like people used to become communists. You know, I've had enough of this. I'm gonna become a Muslim. You know, and if you do that, you know, you will have no room in the tradition you go in. you will just have constriction and limitation, and because the tradition is not transparent to you. You know, Fritjof Schuon talked about the metaphysical transparency of phenomena, which is being able to see God in all things. And then I took more from that, and I started to write about the metaphysical transparency of dogma. The dogma just isn't the limit, you know. I mean, you know, the Christians say that, you know, God.
Schuon was trying to say that.
Yeah, Jenny says Schuon was probably trying to say that. Yeah, but because, you know, he had a degree of that understanding. But, you know, well, why is, you know, God is one and three, okay? And the Christians say God's a Trinity. He's one God and three divine persons. So that's it. You know, well, if you don't have some metaphysical, even, you know, very, very undeveloped metaphysical intuition of what that would be, then it just becomes something you got to believe. I remember, do you remember that old series? What was the series? It was the BBC, wasn't it? It was. No, why am I not remembering it? The Christian, the Anglo-Catholics. No, yes, you did. You know it so well that you can't believe I can't remember the name. So you know. Oh, what was it? It was in this English country house where the Anglo-Catholics lived, and
Brideshead
Revisited.
Oh, right.
Yeah, the old Brideshead Revisited, and there's this character. What's the name of the worldling character?
Sebastian.
The guy who's running for public office. You know.
Max.
Yeah, Max, right. And Max figures he should become a Catholic because it would be good for his political career, you know. So he's going to become a Catholic, or, you know, you know, he's taking catechesis from the priest, and the priest says, you know, how many persons are there in God? How many? And he says, as many as you say, Father, you know, you know, which is perfect. I'll just buy whatever you say, because hey, I'm into it. Okay, he had no desire to understand what that might mean, which is admittedly a very hard thing to understand. But you know,
well, I think for a long time, and pretty much my whole thinking life, and this would be something that I definitely got from my father. I kind of assumed, I took it as a given, and found plenty of confirmation that there were inherent contradictions in Christianity that couldn't be unraveled, and that were just evidence of flaws in the transmission, not the transmission, but the transcription of the transmission. Let's say that the scripture or the interpretation of the scriptures was somehow flawed. Now, I don't necessarily feel that way now. I'm much more willing to put the failing on myself. And I'm definitely revisiting the doctrine, the Christian doctrine, which I've been familiar with for a long time. And really, a lot of it I have taken to heart. I would say that it is deeply meaningful to me, and certainly Christ as an entity is real to me. Yes. But there are still... So, like, I would say I have two primary built-in resistances to becoming in any way traditionally religious. One is intellectual, and that is that there are still certain concepts or interpretations that seem to be integral to Christianity, which I can't quite accept or understand. And the other is social, that I just can't imagine finding a bunch of Christians that I would want to be with, you know?
Well, I understand the second one. I mean, particularly, you know, there are people who, and I've seen this happen with Sufis and with Christians, you know, that they've read all the books, and they've read the saints and the sages and the metaphysicians and the scripture, and they see how true it is, and they're enamored of it, you know, and then they go and they join the religion, and then they're just with a bunch of people who, you know, who have not approached the tradition with that degree of understanding and attraction, but have just been born into it, you know, in the case of ethnic groups, ethnic congregations, or in any case, you know, do not have that same inner understanding. And then this is difficult. You have almost an esoteric understanding of the tradition. Everybody else just accepts it as a sort of matter of fact, and they don't inquire into it very much. So you have no point of communication.
Yeah.
And you're tempted to think that, well, maybe, so let's say with Christianity, maybe I'm really one of the esoteric Christians, one
right.
of the elect.
Right.
You know, and then that doesn't help, especially if you don't find any other elect people to talk to. It gets pretty lonely, and you can get pretty inflated, you know.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. You know, when it comes to the intellectual, look, there are paradoxes in Scripture. There are paradoxes in Christianity. If you understand them, if you take things which your father might have said were contradictions, well, here he says that, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. And then here he says, I come not to bring peace but a sword. So what, you know, can he make up his mind? Can't he make up his mind?
Yeah, no, it isn't those kind. It's like it's more that they're integral to the belief system itself. So, for example, the existence
yeah.
of hell as an eternal realm, on the understanding that everything is God, God is omnipresent and omniscient, therefore hell must exist eternally in God, and therefore if we're in hell, then we're also in God. So, you know, the
exactly.
Things
that,
like
that. That is a true difficulty, you know. Now, Fritjof Schuon, of course, you know, he just said hell is not eternal in the same sense that God is, but it is, what did he say? It's perpetual. Now, exactly what that means, the difference between perpetual and eternal is, you have to go deeply into that and intuit it, and you may not be able to intuit a difference. You know, you can't just say, oh, now I understand it. It's perpetual, not eternal. What the hell does that mean? But, you know, what I say about hell, and I must say that there's certain elements in Christianity, and this is not my.
You accepted in Islam, you could make the same argument against Islam.
Well, in Islam, it says, you know, and if you go to the fire, you'll be there forever unless God has mercy. So it allows a door open, you know.
That's nice.
And what are the doors, Jenny? What are the doors in Christianity?
Well,
in Orthodox Christianity, the idea is that you know, Orthodox Christianity does not make a clear distinction between hell and purgatory as different realms. And so there's also the idea, if you need purgation, you will be sent to hell, you know, temporarily until you've gone through the purgation you need, and then, you know, you're released. And that's possible. And so what is said in Orthodoxy is no one, you know, we know that hell is real, but we can never be sure if anyone is in it, or if a particular person is in it, or if anyone is in it. There are probably plenty of people in hell, but, you know, we can't be dogmatic about that, only about the reality of hell.
Hmm.
So that's how they deal with it.
About people being in hell.
Right.
So-and-so is the worst, you know.
Yeah, you can't be dogmatic about people being in hell. You can say, I don't imagine that Hitler's after-death experience was very positive, but what do you know? I mean, God, this is in God's, the mystery of God's will, which you cannot know.
I was reading C.S. Lewis recently, and that was because you were quoting him, so that sort of brought me, I wouldn't even say back to him, because I haven't read much of him. But anyway, I read Screwtape Letters, and then I read a biography of him. And there was a beautiful thing that he wrote, which was, he said there are two kinds of people, or not two kinds of people, but anyway, two sorts of people. There are those who say to God, thy will be done. And then there are those to whom God says, thy will be done.
Oh, well, you know, I don't know quite what he means by that, but it reminds me of what is said in Sufism about, you know, the sheikh or some sheikhs or some saints who, since they have entirely said, thy will be done, they have no will other than God's. Therefore, whatever they will is God's will. Something like that.
No, he didn't mean it that way. Or at least how I understood it was that those who are estranged from God and in the sort of conventional Christian view are damned by God, it's because it's their will and that they refuse to submit to God's will.
Ironically speaking, yes, God says, if you put your will above mine, then fine, I'm all for it. You know, knock yourself out.
Yeah.
Ironically speaking, yes.
That's the gift of free will, and whatever God's creations do with it, God respects it, even if the will is to burn in hell, so to speak.
Yeah, and Milton is pretty good to show that is a will, you know. They'd rather rule in hell than serve in heaven.
All right. Wasn't Milton, because I was just hearing about Milton, I haven't actually read Paradise Lost, but didn't he describe hell as the furthest distance from God?
Well, I know that as, you know, in my Catholic upbringing, that was it. You know, that the greatest suffering of hell is being cut off from God. You know, on the other hand, it's also interesting what's said in the Screwtape letters, where Screwtape is talking to Wormwood and said he refers to God as the, you know, that terrible burning, searing light that provides the background of permanent pain to our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and this is a little bit more like what the Orthodox Christians will say about hell. What they say is God doesn't damn anyone because God is love. He loves all. But those who are damned cannot stand to be loved.
Yeah.
You know, they hate love, and they hate his love, and I suppose they feel that his love is going to take them out of themselves and take them away from themselves and deny themselves to themselves, and so they reject it, and their rejection of and resistance of God's love is hellfire.
Mm.
And that's pretty sophisticated. Because you can see that happening psychologically, you know, in this life, you know, in a lot of ways.
I
remember I was once doing a poetry reading out in Union Square in San Francisco. And I don't know how beautiful my poetry was, but I was the poetry reading. I was at the microphone reading it. And there was a bum. There was a wino, you know, who was sleeping in the park, and he was hearing all this poetry come out at him, and he woke up, and he just said, "Oh Christ, shut up! No, I don't want to know. I don't want to hear it. No, God, damn, no, damn, you get away." So I just thought, this, you know, maybe we weren't that beautiful. Maybe he had good taste and realized we were reading a bunch of crap. This is possible. But what I saw in that was, this is someone to whom beauty is coming, and he doesn't want it because his soul is too damaged and too constricted to be able to open to it.
I love how you word all your lies. I learned a lot. I'm no longer a guy. So sit tight and close your eyes. I'll get you the pony.
think we can all relate to that. I mean, it squares with my own experience that I was describing earlier, and also an idea my mother used to refer to sometimes, which is divine discontent.
What did she mean by that? That's an interesting.
Insofar as we are estranged from God, we will be unhappy. And so, yes. And so my initial experience of God, let's say, even though I might not have framed it that way at the time, was how unhappy I was. And I knew that I didn't know why, but I knew that there was a reason, and I also knew that that reason wasn't in the world.
Yes.
Or at least not in the way that other things are in the world, actually. God is in the world, but not.
Yes, but I mean, in other words, it wouldn't be taken care of by the change in a circumstance, by a new job or a new love or a new something.
No, actually, I experienced it at a closest level as a desire to fly. Like I would come home, and I was living in New York on Third Avenue and Third Street, and I'd drink every night or every other night, and I'd come home half drunk or totally drunk, and I would feel this unbelievable irrational longing to leave the earth, just to float 1 foot above the earth. Which is actually kind of dissociative thing, really, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that may be the, you know, the motivation behind a lot of astral projection. Mm. If the material world is unnaturally constricted because you don't love it, you will want to get away. You know, and of course, ultimately that can lead to suicide. But, you know, I understand that feeling. In fact, didn't you get a letter once? I don't know how this prisoner in San Quentin heard of you, Jenny. Yeah, she got a letter from a prisoner in San Quentin, and I forget why, you know, they corresponded for a very short time. But he was talking about how he was learning astral projection. He got a book, he's going to learn astral projection. Because, boy, if you're in prison, you know, that's very attractive.
Yeah.
You know, you want to lie on your bed and fly wherever you want, you know. So,
yeah,
but I found that my experience with such things as astral projection, which I wasn't very serious about learning, although I did sort of dabble in lucid dreaming or setting up lucid dreaming at one point. But what I found is when I first joined the Sufis, that kind of experience ended.
Mm. Right. For me, it ended when I started seeing a Jungian therapist, actually. It was a very brief period, but she was very good. I don't know how Jungian she was, actually, but she recommended Donald Calshed, who is a Jungian therapist and wrote an excellent book called The Inner World of Trauma. And her advice to me in the brief time that, because she was doing it for free out of generosity, was to, in my dreams, to stop flying away, you know, into the cosmos and just bring my attention back to the body. And that was her advice generally in life as well, and also in our sessions. She didn't want to hear all about my big cosmic dreams, and she wanted everything to be brought down to earth. And she was absolutely right. I mean, that was my 40th year, and the 10 years since then have all been, that's been the trajectory. It's all been about not flying away, but actually trying to land, trying to get.
Well, and if you're getting attracted to Christianity, this is what's known as incarnation, right? I mean, there are spiritualities which say, rise, fly above the body, go to the higher world. But in Christianity, you know, God is incarnate in flesh. And so through your fleshly experience, through God's immanence, you know, you will find his transcendence. And vice versa. But, you know, it doesn't reject the flesh. And people always think that Christianity is so rejecting of the flesh. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, it was more accepting. It's rejecting of the passions, which only distort the flesh. But it certainly accepts the flesh completely because, you know, why would Christ incarnate in human flesh if human flesh was fundamentally flawed or unreal or whatever other people may think?
Mm. Yes, as a Christian, Christians say it's an anti-Christian dogma to say the flesh is evil.
Yeah.
Per se, you can be too worldly, too involved.
Yeah.
And also, I want to say about Christianity, it has to be understood on an existential level. Maybe other religions have to too. I don't know.
At one point.
But, you know. The intellectual pagans who were very wise, I mean, Plotinus and those people, they have a lot to say. And I wouldn't just, you can't just discount them. But they didn't get Christianity because of something existential. They weren't there the way the people
were. Yeah, and if Christianity looked you know, foolish intellectually, or like a religion for slaves and
yes.
you know, and rather simple-minded idiots, you know, which is what a lot of those people, Platonists thought. It's because they didn't, right, they didn't get the existential
yes.
sense of what it is. Because
yes.
if they got the existential sense, then the intellectual sense would open up for them.
Mm.
Remember Kutzinger's story about Porphyry?
Porphyry.
And it said that somebody came to him and said, oh, you ought to go to a mass. And he said, why? And he said, oh, there's angels and all that sort of thing. At the mass, and the Porphyry says, what is actually up to such beings to come to me? that's somehow...
I want such beings to come to me.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that I guess, was theory. His idea was angels are only really interesting if you command their appearance.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
whereas if you just go someplace and pick up on them, that is rather
rather
gauche. You know.
yeah. Well, that's occultism in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah.
I said making the principles subject to the individual's own will.
Right. And I'm sure there's better things in the whole tradition of Greek theurgy than that, but that's
yes.
what it ended up to be, because it pretty much was the history of Western ceremonial magic as it developed in the Renaissance, was, you know, people going back outside of an ongoing spiritual tradition, or only, you know, partially Christian, you know, and partially outside of the church, and digging up the old pagan writings and doing something with them. And so there you get ceremonial magic, which is probably on a much lower level than it was the first time around.
Isn't it actually on a whole new topic here, but it's a kind of a religious heresy, occultism, isn't it? I don't just mean in the sense that religious sees it as heresy, but that in its very essence, it's a kind of rebellion, occultism.
Well, depending on how you define it. But yes, you know, I mean, Western occultism came because, first, the Catholic Church was becoming more narrow.
Yeah.
And, you know, it
and corrupt.
And corrupt, mm-hmm. yeah. We've just been watching the series on the Borgias,
oh, yeah.
to get a clear idea of how corrupt it got. But,
I have that book on the whole problems with the church and the turmoil that's been going on for many, many centuries.
What book is that?
Just a minute.
Yeah, she's going to get that book.
Yeah.
But, you know, and a certain degree of the a lot of the metaphysical understanding was lost to the Catholic Church when there was this schism with the Eastern Church, and so since it was still entirely valid and produced saints, but it was narrow.
I never read all this book, but
oh, Tumultuous Times.
Yes.
By who?
What's his name? Talk to his brother. He's
Oh, yeah, the Radecki, right.
Radecki, yeah.
Father Radecki.
Yeah.
Tumultuous Times, 20 General Councils of the Catholic Church and Vatican II and its aftermath. So, but anyway, it became, you know, had a narrowed vision. And so when all this material mm-hmm. was coming back, you know, into the consciousness of the West through the revival of studies of paganism, you know, it was the whole Hermetic tradition, which was basically, you know, a Greek rendition of what was left of Egyptian lore, and, you know, other things like the Chaldean oracles and the Platonic material and all this was coming back, and the church wasn't big enough to contain it, so you know, it had to reject some of it as heretical or just not be able to contain it without being uncentered by it. So out of that was born a parallel stream of occultism, where the people who, You know, they might go, they might still be Christians and go to Mass and follow the sacraments, but they had this special extra other thing that they were learning, which was, you know, various forms of paganism and pagan philosophy and ultimately magic. I mean, you know, Renaissance magic is strange because a lot of it, you know, is on the premise that, well, since Christ has conquered the kingdom of Satan, therefore the demons are now working for us because we're Christians. So what we will do is we'll invoke angels in order to give us the power to turn around and invoke devils to do the stuff we really want, like, you know, finding buried treasure or getting, you know, getting the lover we want or whatever. And so, you know, obviously this was a great deviation because, you know, whereas in the Eastern Church, it seems to me, pagan wisdom, the Platonic wisdom, there's a bit more space for it, you know, and of course, Augustine and Aquinas, you know, really, and the, you know, the Western fathers knew a lot about Plato and Aristotle and, you know, and drew upon them a great deal, but it seems like there were elements, of the pagan, wisdom that were more completely integrated into the Eastern Church without thereby making it, you know, heterodox or disturbing it or violating its center. So anyway, that's why you had more of an occult tradition paralleling the Catholic Church in the West, as I see it.
Well, I've been working on an old book, I don't know, Thomas Erpin's, and I'm kind of embarrassed by it, but I also feel I have to atone for it because it was a lot of occultic beliefs that I adhered to and I put it out there. But anyway, so I've been rewriting it in the hope of, you know, I can actually, you know, make amends for it by, and one of the things that occurred to me was that occultism is kind of like the negative identity of religion. In the sense I was talking about earlier, you know, how if we're traumatized and we don't have a healthy ego, and we don't have a healthy culture within which to grow, then we just look for things to rebel against, things to oppose ourselves against, and develop an identity based on opposition, an oppositional identity, and which of course is Luciferian. And then occultism, it seems to me, if you look at Crowley as an embodiment of modern occultism, his whole thing was just a rebellion.
Yeah, I mean, he couldn't flourish nowadays because there are too many people like him, and you know the church is not a formidable, you know, opponent that he can measure himself against, you know, just as likely to invite him into one of their interfaith events, you know.
No, which of course is evidence of how effective he was, partly because.
Well, yeah, and he and everybody else was going in that direction, right?
Yeah.
What was I going to say? Oh, if you're doing Lent now, I would suggest a book to you, which was written by my wife Jenny with my help, which is called The Ordeal of Mercy, Dante's Purgatorio in Light of the Spiritual Path. And I think it's a perfect Lenten book because, you know, I mean, Dante goes through all of the different passions and sins, and you really see the analysis of how they are and how they work and what they are the counterfeit forms of and what is required to get beyond them. It's, you know, people don't realize how great Dante. I mean, everybody says he's great, but they don't know why.
Yeah, I'm aware of the book, and I did consider getting it. I sure wouldn't be able to get it before the end of Lent now. And one of the things that stopped me was that I'm not familiar with Dante, but I'm sure that wouldn't be an obstacle to reading it. It might even be a good way to...
Dante, you see, actually, what I just said about the Western Church not able to incorporate all this pagan wisdom, Dante is the exception to that. Dante was able to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, he has, you know, almost all of the sources of philosophy or religion that were available at the time, he somehow, you know, makes a place for. Sometimes it's, you know, just as a lesser wisdom than the Christian wisdom. Other times it's, you know, as inverted or lost kind of wisdom, but he's incredibly comprehensive in drawing upon pre-Christian sources. And, you know, but this is possibly because he also had an esoteric order that he was most likely involved with called the Fedeli d'Amore, the faithful to love. And some people believe that these were actually a kind of third order of the Templars. You know, the third order, the first order in monasticism, the first order is the order of the monks, the second order is the order of the nuns, and the third order is the order of the laymen who follow, you know, that's, you know, an element of that same path while being in the world. So, you know, you could have third order Franciscans who you know, do Franciscan prayers and Franciscan, you know, practices, but they're living in the world. So the Fedeli d'Amore, some people say it was like a third order of the Templars for lay people. Mm. Who knows? But it did apparently have some contact with Sufism at one point, although we don't know how or when. But you see some affinities.
And was Dante famous in his time, if that's the word for back then? Was he well?
Was it called that in its time?
Yeah. Was he widely read and recognized?
Yes, I think that he would do canto at a time, and I think it was even read orally.
You say, was Dante famous in his time,
yes.
or was the fact that he was connected with the Fedeli d'Amore well known? What are you asking?
No, the first question, yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. What he did is essentially he helped create modern Italian, because he wrote in the vernacular, and so many of the other, you know, great works, et cetera, were written in Latin, but he was in a poetic movement called the Dolce Stil Nuovo, the beautiful, the sweet new style, and with other poets who were, you know, taking Tuscan Italian and turning it into the basis of what finally became the Italian language. You know, see, he was well known, and there's an amazing story about Dante, which is, some of the last cantos of the Paradiso, he believed would, you know, cause him to run afoul of the church and of the Inquisition. So he hid them. And after he died, people collected his writings, and the Paradiso seemed incomplete. They said, is this really the end, or, you know, what? But then one of his followers had a dream of Dante, where Dante appeared in a white robe, and et cetera, and said, look in the wall of the house I used to live in, you will find the other cantos. And his follower did that and did indeed find them. That's why we have the complete Divine Comedy. Hmm. That's, of course, disputed like everything. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was no Jesus Christ. There was no Moses. There was no
Shakespeare either, apparently.
Shakespeare. Oh, yeah. Particularly.
Well, we've been on 2 hours, 12 minutes, and I think I need to take a walk in the sun while I still can. So
take a walk.
We should wind up. Did Jenny know that this was for a podcast, by the way? Because you're now part of it. Although
I think she knew.
I sort of knew.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be better if you had your own microphone. So if we do it again, maybe.
Yes.
We can, great. Well, thanks, Charles, and thanks, Jenny, for joining in there at the end. Are you doing Lent, by the way?
Yes. I do more reading than normally and that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, there's a real Lenten fast in Orthodoxy, but in Catholicism, not so much.
Yeah.
I can't do the rigorous fast. I get sick if I try and do it.
Yeah, Jenny can't fast.
Oh, I can't
much.
Quite fast either. I'm like as skinny as a person can be without dying. And yeah, I try fasting. It doesn't suit me. No, also I'm reading this a lot. My main actually impetus was something I read in your book, Charles, about how contemplation is of more value than expression. And I thought, my God, I
told myself that.
Right. Yeah, well, maybe you have a similar problem to me because I'm just a compulsive expresser, and particularly with the internet, like I have this weekly podcast and a blog, and I just do it constantly. So I thought at the very least I'm going to take Lent off from expressing and see if that opens some space for contemplation. And it's been surprisingly hard, actually. I mean, there's something in me that.
Yeah, you could. There's even possible to do a vow of silence, even for like a few days.
Yeah,
and you know that can really change things.
Might be tricky working in the thrift store.
Yeah, but you could have a lot of little cards with different answers on them.
Okay, well that was really fun. I'm glad that we got to do this. And as you know, I've been really very much impacted by your writing. So thank you for that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because, you know, I would write and not for the longest time I wrote not necessarily believing that anybody would write it. You know, I was sort of hoping that some of my political activities had put me on an FBI list, and so I was under surveillance. And if I was under surveillance, I felt like I was being heard, and, since I was being public, you know.
Right.
But you know, now I see that people just come and they say, you know, what you wrote was helpful, and that was in the back of my mind always, is to, because there was an awful lot of, you know, intellectual and moral and emotional knots that I had to get through, and I'm still getting through, and. As soon as I would get through one, I would try to write down how I did it, even though I wasn't writing very biographically. You know, that was sort of the idea behind, you know, my motivation to write on metaphysics and the spiritual life.
Right. Well, that was definitely the function it served for me. And I think that intellectual error is truly rife now in our world. And we're seeing the correlation between intellectual error and moral error for sure in every corner.
Jenny just tells me she saw something on, you know, this Red Ice Radio.
Yeah.
Well, apparently they have a story on there. I don't know if this is true. Don't sue me. But they claim that Richard Dawkins has put in a good word for cannibalism because. It's another step of overcoming, you know, irrational prejudices and things like this caused by religion.
Okay, that is the end of my conversation with Charles Upton. I hope to have another one sooner rather than later. Next week's podcast will be with Nick Kalani about Jordan Peterson and Jesus and stuff. I'd just like to ask listeners to keep an eye on Prisoner of Infinity. Strange things happening there. It's not allowing people to review it, even though 8 people already have. So changes have been made there. The ostensible reason is it hasn't been released yet, which is technically true, as in the release date is April 30th at Amazon.com, which is a mistake. But obviously the book is available. People have bought it there and reviewed it. So I'm not sure what's happening there. I won't speculate because there's no point. But I guess people keep an eye on it and keep trying if you have tried, and if you have read the book, or even if you just read the series and feel that you have a good enough idea of it to review the book, it's very close to the same material, then I do ask listeners and readers to review that book as well as Seen and Not Seen in order to help amplify the signal and reach other readers. Okay, till next week, thanks for listening. This is The Limitless.